on ABC Radio New South Wales. This is the Country Hour.
And I'm Michael Condon on the program today. Well, we find that there's no better way to get a young person interested in agriculture than to give them some hands-on experience. We talk to some people that are looking to a future, some young people looking to a future in the wool industry. And we also turn the spotlight on the Inland Rail as well, because new research is out from the CSIRO. It's revealed far greater savings than first thought. We'll find out more about that. You might have some views on the Inland Rail. You can always send us a text here at the Country Hour. It has been a very contentious issue indeed. 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. And we'll also have some more dairy news as well, drilling down into what Norco suppliers are actually going to get in terms of an increase. But first up, let's look at the Inland Rail issue, because new research by the CSIRO has revealed the Inland Rail project could deliver far greater freight savings for agriculture than first thought. The science agency found switching from road to rail could save an average $76 a tonne, or about $70 million a year. Farmers have cautiously welcomed the findings, including Anthony Statz from Koala Farms in Queensland's Lockyer Valley.
Oh, look, any savings welcomed in the hort industry. We see it as being a big opportunity to be able to get our product to market a lot cheaper than what it currently costs. So if those levels are hit, that'd be great.
What sort of detail would you be looking for going forward?
Well, we'd need to understand what the handling cost would be for product to get it to the train and off the train to market. There's a fair bit of detail in that. Most Horti products are refrigerated, so there's a whole cool chain compliance that the rail would need to be able to compete with road transport.
And in terms of the hub where you would send the produce to first, what's your understanding about what those arrangements could be?
Well, clearly the location of the hub will be important, that it's close enough that it doesn't incur a lot of cost to get the product to the train for a start, but then clearly the handling facilities that are there will need to be quite specific to handle the different horticultural products.
If it all goes to plan, as you hope it does, what could the gains be for you in terms of supplying the market, say, down in Melbourne and New South Wales?
Yeah, well, what effectively it'll just make us more cost competitive with other products in that market. So at the moment, one of the limiting things is the cost of freight to get your product to that market, and any reduction in that cost component will make us more competitive and should result in more sales.
General Manager of Koala Farms, Anthony Statz, speaking with Jody Gunders. Well, let's turn our attention to New South Wales. So how do those figures and findings come in terms of any surprise to those who live on this section of the Inland Rail between Parkes and Narromine in western New South Wales? The train line, of course, will dissect the Parkes Shire, which has been developing itself as a bit of a freight hub. The council's general manager, Kent Boyd, told the ABC's Christy Reading that the CSIRO's report backs up what they have long believed.
Look, not really. I think the original study was very conservative in many aspects, and the $10 a tonne quoted in that document, I think, is quite a conservative view. CSIRO, they've got a transit model, which is actually a complex, you know, mathematical, analytical model, which really tries to track all the savings, as I understand. So I think it's a much more realistic and much more, precise calculation.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, why do you think the cost benefit has increased? Is it just down to this study? Of course, the CSIRO has been looking at the transport of fruit, vegetables and processed agriculture, such as meat, rice and dairy, throughout central western New South Wales. Is it just this comprehensive look, or do you think things have changed in other parts of our transport system?
Look, I think it's probably a combination of all those things. We know rail is actually much more efficient. You know, a single train takes something like 110 trucks off the road. Carbon emissions are 40% higher on road than they are for rail. Safety is something like, you know, road travel causes something like 8 times more accidents per kilometre travelled. So rail is actually a very efficient way to move freight over long distances. So as I say, I think the original document had a lot of conservatism in it. But the most important thing, I think, for inland rail are these really efficient points to get on and off, which I think the industry are responding to quite well. And once the industry actually understands, you know, exactly how this the inland rail is going to operate, I think we will realise quite significant savings, and it's quite a game changer, certainly for inland New South Wales and Eastern Australia.
Mm. Well, the savings that the report promises have been described as groundbreaking by one grain grower who will have the inland rail running through his property. Neil Westcott farms at Alecktown near Parkes and believes the findings vindicate the project. He spoke to the ABC's Kathleen Ferguson and says the rail line is a key to Australia's ability to compete in global markets.
We're playing catch-up in Australia and have been for some time. This important link to the seaboard will give us what many other countries and even the likes of the Western Australian guys have had for a long time, just being able to get good cost-effective access to ports and markets in a timely manner. And it's something that to compete on a global market, we desperately need.
There are some concerns along the line, mainly north of you, where farmers are not happy with the level of consultation or transparency, some saying that they're ripping up their access agreements. Do you think that this study, this report from the CSIRO, will go away in helping convince some farmers along the line of the benefits of this project from the bigger picture perspective?
Oh, look, I hope so. The rail line itself has obviously caused a lot of controversy on the greenfield sites. But, of course, I realise that I am living on next to an existing rail line, and, you know, it's not something that's going to change me dramatically as opposed to somebody that may have a new rail line through their property.
And in terms of just what the report has found, were you surprised by the cost savings at all?
Well, it takes believing, to be honest. It is enormous. I think if we can go anywhere near to where that they are claiming to be those cost savings to be, it'll be an absolutely groundbreaking thing for us out here. It's a wonderful result, and certainly it should be. It's a part of the consideration, but it's a confirmation for all sides of politics that this inland rail is something the nation is desperately needed and will provide enormous benefits in the generations to come.
That's Neil Westcott, who farms near Parkes at Alecktown. You're listening to The Country Hour, 13 minutes past 12. Got a text in already. Rod at Mudgee's texted in, the cost benefits will decrease as the budget blows out. Started at $9 billion, now at $13. The East Narromine option is wrong and needs to be investigated, says Rod. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 14 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, with the New South Wales election on Saturday, politicians are on the beat this week telling regional communities what they can do for them. Sally Bryant caught up with Labor's Shadow Minister for Primary Industries, Mick Veitch, to find out what he has planned for rural voters if elected. She started out by asking what he can do around the contentious issue of water.
We have said that we'll have a special commission of inquiry in New South Wales if we're elected on the weekend, with Royal Commission powers. And that'll draw on information from the South Australian Royal Commission. One of the problems with the South Australian Royal Commission was that the New South Wales public servants, and indeed politicians, weren't able to give evidence. They weren't permitted to give evidence by the government. So we'll have our own inquiry here in New South Wales to look at what has gone on and what lessons are to be learnt about what has gone on. That's the first thing. And we're also going to replace the cease to pump rules in the Darling. We're also going to look at the 2012 water sharing plan, what took place there and what can be done to improve all of that. The reality is the drought has a part of the role to play here, but it is not the total issue. There has been mismanagement of the rivers, and you know, down my part of the world in Tumut, the river is running very high there at the moment, but that's because water's got to come from somewhere to meet our requirements for the Murray-Darling Basin commitments. And so if the Darling's empty, it's got to come from somewhere else. So the mismanagement of the Darling affects a lot of parts of regional New South Wales.
How concerned are you about the divisiveness of this issue across river communities? Because things have got really ugly, and some politicians have actually just turned this into a point scoring exercise, which has actually brought even more pressure onto people who are already badly suffering in the drought.
Yeah, common sense has to prevail. And I think a part of the reason why we want this Special Commission of Inquiry is, can we just get to the bottom of all this so we can work forward together? Like, can we prepare a plan to work forward together in Western New South Wales about how we can share the water resource, how we can better use the water resource, and we can make sure that we all have equal access to the water resource? Because, you know, the people at the top of the river will say they get the water resource. People at the bottom of the river say they miss out. Look, let's put all that to one side. We have to work together. We actually live in the community. I mean, the Barkindji people along the Darling have got a thousands of years of managing and working with that river. Maybe we can learn some lessons from our local Indigenous people. Like, I think common sense prevails. You are right. People their sensitivities are quite heightened because of words that politicians say. And I think the community actually does want to work together. That's my impression. And I'd like to be a part of helping that happen.
What is your understanding about the pressure that drought-affected farmers in this part of the world are under because of the forced, or the very poor consultation around the inland rail? I understand that the New South Wales opposition has said that they will have an upper house inquiry, but what realistically could your government, if elected, do to influence what the outcome's going to be there?
The people have been saying this. They actually want an inquiry. They want a parliamentary inquiry. We've listened to that, and so we will have a parliamentary inquiry. The reality is consultation has been very poor around the corridor and for the inland rail. It could have been done a lot better, and I think most people would accept that.
In the past, the opposition has been very scathing about changes made to native vegetation legislation. What is your current attitude to the situation as it stands in New South Wales at the moment, and what would your policy be as far as changing legislation?
So we have said that we're not going to repeal or throw out the government's laws. There's been a lot of change already. What we have said, though, is wherever you go around New South Wales, on the ground, people raise issues, and they raise different issues in different parts of the state. So it is quite clear that the government's proposals are not going very well. There are issues on the ground. We will have an inquiry. We'll have set up a task force. The farmers will have a seat with that task force, and that is to find out what the issues are and what is the way forward.
That's the ALP's Shadow Minister for Primary Industries, Mick Veitch. You might have some views on his comments there. 0467 922 684, the inland rail. Also, native vegetation as well. We'll be looking at that issue again shortly. You can send us a text. 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. Meanwhile, the current minister, Niall Blair, has been campaigning in the Central West this week as well, and he's been critical of Labor's financial commitment to farmers, given the ongoing nature of the drought.
We know now from the Labor costings that they have forgotten to include drought assistance in their election commitments. At each election, every party must submit their shopping list for the checkout. As you go around an election campaign, you have to say what you're going to do and then take it to the checkout, which is the Parliamentary Budget Office, and they collate all of those commitments and see whether you can pay for it. Unfortunately, Labor has forgotten many of the key elements that our regional communities need at the moment. They have forgotten to include the $350 million for drought support for our Farm Innovation Fund. They have forgotten to include the wild dog fence in Western New South Wales. And when they said that they were going to add an extra $1 billion for water security, they've forgotten to actually submit it. They only put in $500 million. So the Shadow Treasurer needs to have a good look in his office, because there's nearly $1 billion sitting on the floor somewhere that he forgot to submit to the Parliamentary Budget Office, and that nearly $1 billion should be coming to regional New South Wales. When it comes to their election commitments, they haven't mentioned the word drought once. They also have forgotten to actually submit the application to the Parliamentary Budget Office for their $35 million worth of Landcare funding. They say now that it can just come out of a community bucket. Well, every stakeholder across the state that has been given a commitment from Labor needs to be very wary and have a look at the fine print, because it looks like they'll be all competing over the same bucket of money, and we think that bucket has been committed two or three times.
That's the Minister for Primary Industries, Niall Blair, speaking there on his visit to the Central West this week. It's 20 minutes past 12. Got a few texts in on a few issues. Inland Rail, Mick says he heard a few years back that land was purchased in the path of the Inland Rail by a high-ranking politician. Also, he says this rail avenue can be used for other purposes that haven't been mentioned very much, such as gas pipelines, etc. Also, the floodplains and the effects to flooding and farms disruption also should be looked at more closely, according to Mick. And Bob's texted in saying, wow, the government maybe will now understand that rail freight is cheaper and safer than road. That's always been the case, but I suppose it was more lucrative to let the plebs burn fossil fuels and tyres and increase the road toll and maintenance costs while wasting thousands of lifetimes of productive labour that could have been more usefully employed somewhere else. Federal ICAC, please, he says, and what are the state ICACs doing in regards to various issues at the moment? And a few more texts have come in. We'll get to them shortly, because we'll stay with politics now, and with the election only a few days away, the major parties are refining their views on native vegetation. The coalition are looking to change the way grasslands are treated, and Labor has toned down its rhetoric around the biodiversity legislation. But farmers say weeds are a significant threat and they need a clearer roadmap from the major parties. Josh Becker has more.
Farmers in southeast New South Wales say weeds are taking over native pastures and regulations are leading to poor outcomes for farmers and conservationists. John Murdoch farms near Bombala, and he says while politicians are listening to farmers, they've not received any firm policy commitments.
What we want to see is a distinction between native grasslands, native dominant grasslands that are of high conservation value and that of low conservation value. We're really saying if it's not of conservation value, it shouldn't be regulated. And we've presented a solution for this, which both parties have seen. We've had some, I would call it, as little commitment as humanly possible from the Coalition or the National Party and Liberal Party at the moment. I guess the time has come where we can't wait for any more action on this. We've had 30 years of regulation that I don't think's achieved anything. In fact, I think the native grasslands are worse due to weeds than they were when regulation started. And I don't think any conservation objectives are really truly being achieved under current regulations.
Primary Industries Minister Niall Blair, speaking at a pre-election forum, acknowledged that grasslands across New South Wales require different rules.
We think that we need a Monero code that would sit underneath the biodiversity system that we have, that specifically addresses some of the issues around grasslands here, and that will come off the back of the pilots that are happening here.
Noel Blair says the current regulations send the wrong message to farmers and will only increase the spread of weeds.
There is a perverse outcome for a farmer to treat until basically the farm gets infested. That's the perverse outcome that we have at the moment in the way that it's set. That's why we needed to do this pilot. That's why you need to walk those paddocks. The restrictions that farmers have had to control pockets or parts of their farm have meant that they were better off just sitting back and let it become an infestation, so then they can go and spray the whole lot and cultivate the whole lot and then sow it down to pasture. That's actually not what any of us, I think, want. And that's why we need to get this specific code in.
The Environment Minister, Gabrielle Upton, was contacted for more policy detail on the Monero code, but has not responded. Labor Environment spokesperson Penny Sharp says the biodiversity laws have gone too far in farmers' favour and will work to remake the laws. But Penny Sharp committed that farmers would play a key role at the table.
What Labor has said we will do is that we will remake the current laws. The laws that were put in place by the Liberals and particularly by the National Party in the most recent Parliament are not laws that we think are working well, and we do not think they protect native vegetation. So Labor said that we're going to work with environmentalists, scientists and farmers to remake those laws to give proper protection for vegetation.
If Labor were to form a minority government after the state election, would native vegetation laws be used as a trading tool with some of the minor parties, the Greens or the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers, when you're discussing, or do you would you be able to make a commitment to farmers that that this wouldn't be used as a political football post the election?
Labor's only concentrating on one thing, and that is hoping to win in our own right the 23rd of March. Anything else is a hypothetical that we constantly get asked, but look, we're not, as I said to you before, what we're interested in is working with all stakeholders at the table. We know that farmers are key partners, but we also have to follow the science, so we want to work through those issues with them.
But for farmer John Murdoch, without a clear roadmap from either party post-election, he says the grasslands will be worse off.
I fear for the Monero grassland in 10 years' time if we continue on the same path, not through land clearing but through weed spread. Like I think 10, 15 years' time is a very real possibility with African love grass, serrated tussock and even now Chilean needle grass, that there is no grasslands left that are of any conservation significance.
Monero grazier John Murdoch ending that report by Josh Becker. It's 26 minutes past 12.
My name is Rachel Nicholl, and you're listening to the ABC Country Hour.
Got a few more texts coming in on the Inland Rail. Mark at Moss Vale's texted in saying, Rod says the Narromine to Narrabri-Greenfield part of the Inland Rail is wrong, but he doesn't say why. Most of the commentary I've heard on this issue, according to Mark, suggests that only people who don't want to see the new railway on their land think it's wrong. The information about Inland Rail has been on the internet for many years, and I see no reason to have a costly inquiry into the matter in the hope that they can get their own way. Someone's also texted in to say, in regards to water, Phil says after creating an irrigation drought in southern New South Wales, now the environmental water holder in Victoria is selling water back to whoever can afford the $450 a meg. And Phil asks the question, is this really Australian? There's a whole bunch more of texts there. We'll get to them a little bit later on in the program. But now it's time to turn our attention to milk, because Norco suppliers will receive 1.4 cents a litre for milk after Coles lifted the price of its home brand milk by 10 cents a litre yesterday. The dairy cooperative supplies 70 million litres of milk to Coles for its home brand milk per year, which represents only about a third of Norco's total milk volume. The 1.4 cent lift is in addition to the 6.5 cent a litre increase previously announced. Norco told its suppliers via email late yesterday that the 1.4 cent figure is dependent on sales of Coles home brand milk and total Norco milk intake volume, which can vary month to month. Dorigo Norco supplier Adam Darley says Coles lifting its home brand milk price by 10 cents a litre is a positive outcome and a move in the right direction.
We're definitely putting a positive spin on it, and we'd like to actually call it a price catch-up since we haven't had a price rise since 2011.
And so what sort of difference is it going to make to you? Norco has informed its suppliers late yesterday that they will receive a 1.4 cent a litre lift on the back of that news, and that's in addition to the 6.5 cents previously announced. Those are two increases to cover April, May and June.
Yeah, look, I'm banking on what we know at the moment is that we do have that lift in that pay for that set period of time. So, you know, 7.9 cents, nearly 8 cents a litre. I think with the price of grain, it's increased by 2.5 times, within the last 2 years, which on my farm, that relates back to about 6 to 7 cents per litre extra in costs. So at this stage, it's only going to cover that extra feed cost that we are incurring at the moment.
Were you expecting a little bit more than 1.4 cents?
Look, I was. We'd all like, once Coles had made that decision that they were going to lift it by 10 cents, I think a lot of farmers said, oh, beauty, we're going to get the 10 cents. Norco had also made a statement that they were going to lift their price by 6.5 cents. So they kind of added the two together and thought, oh, this is going to be really great. But the reality is that Norco's contract with Coles is only around about, you know, 35% of their total production. So once you shift that 10 cents across the whole amount of litres that that Norco receives, it's going to be much less than 10 cents.
But there would be a lot of consumers out there questioning why that 10 cents isn't fully being passed on. Well, they think that it's not being fully passed on when they see that Norco suppliers are only going to get 1.4 cents a litre after the announcement.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And because if we provided 100% of our product to Coles, that would relate to a 10 cents a litre lift. But what we need to do now is try and push all dairy products in the supermarket cabinet to be lifted by around about that 10 cents. And then that will give the full benefit of a price increase back to all farmers, not only in New South Wales, Queensland, but we want to try and pick up other dairy farmers across Australia, in Victoria, South Australia as well. So we do have a united push for a raise in dairy products right across the board.
As Norco supplier Adam Darley from Dorrigo on the New South Wales Coffs Coast, and the ABC has contacted Norco for comment on the 1.4 cent lift. On the Country Hour, it's 28 minutes to one. It's time to get some news headlines from Helen Zaremas. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. The state's unemployment rate has risen. Official figures show it rose from 3.9% to 4.3% last month. The national unemployment rate has fallen to 4.9%. The state opposition leader, Michael Daly, says the pressure of the election campaign led to some blunders last night during the final leaders' debate. Mr. Daly struggled with a question about education and TAFE spending. He says he and the Premier Gladys Berejiklian made mistakes. Ms. Berejiklian wrongly said the M4 west of Parramatta will be tolled. Northern Territory Emergency Services and the Defence Force are preparing for what is believed to be the largest evacuation in NT history since Cyclone Tracy. Communities in Groote Eylandt, Borroloola, Robinson River and Noombulwa are among those being evacuated ahead of Tropical Cyclone Trevor's predicted landfall on Saturday. More news at one, Michael.
Trevor could bring some rain to New South Wales. Good old Trevor. Maybe we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Cyclone Michael would be interesting.
Cyclone Helen.
Anyway, let's hope everybody is safe.
That's true, but I mean, some rain in New South Wales would be nice as well.
Oh, God, I know. What can we do? If only there was something we could
Fingers
do.
Fingers crossed. Well, we'll find out from the Weather Bureau now. You
Lovely.
Can listen, Helen.
I will.
Okay. Helen Zaremas there. Thanks for that. Let's find out what's happening with the weather. And Gabrielle Woodhouse is there. Now, Gabrielle, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, Trevor could bring white rain, but it's a bit too early to say. We don't really know yet.
Yeah, so I mean, quite typically with these sorts of tropical cyclone systems, it's very difficult to tell exactly what path it's going to take. So currently, Trevor's sitting up in the far north Queensland, and it looks as though it'll eventually start to move south over the weekend. And with that, it's going to drag a little bit of moisture that we might be able to tap into across New South Wales. So on the weekend, we'll see a Sunday and into Monday, we'll see a front that's going to cross the state. Now, the timing of that front and how it interacts with Trevor and the moisture it's bringing down, that could bring potentially widespread rainfall across New South Wales. In terms of rainfall totals, that's a bit of a question mark at the moment, because it will depend on the exact timing of the front and exactly the position of Trevor.
So there's sort of two systems that could come together and be pushed further south and bring more rainfall. A bit of the remnants of Trevor could come deeper into the state or not.
Yeah, so if the front is a little bit later, it means that we have more ability to reach into that moisture from Trevor, and then we'll see much higher widespread totals. But if that front moves through quite quickly, then we won't be able to tap into that moisture, and a lot of that rainfall will be more over Queensland rather than New South Wales. So it is something that we have to sort of, you know, obviously keep a very close eye on. But it does look as though most places west of the divide will see some form of rain over the weekend and into Monday. But at this point, rainfall totals can vary quite wildly. It seems it's looking a little bit more likely now on Sunday that the southern district, so say south of about Parks to about Broken Hill, that we could see you know, a couple of millimetres more, maybe 5 to 15 millimetres in places. So I think that's, you know, at least a little bit of something out there, but it's still a bit of a wait and see game for the rainfall.
So on the computer models, what's the variance like? Some are saying 5 to 15 and some are saying potentially more, but it just depends on what pattern they have this, the remnants of the cyclone following.
Yeah, so I mean, even say for Sunday, there's a few models that are saying you could get up to sort of, you know, 20 or 30 millimetres in places. But like I said, that's that sort of bullseye of where it's trying to pick that is shifting around a fair amount. And that's due to the timing of the front and also the placement of Trevor. So it's a bit of a convoluted and uncertain period, but it does look as though we will see some rainfall west of the divide.
So so the Trevor will feed in some way, but we just don't know how much.
Exactly.
Okay, and it will depend on where those systems are. So I guess we'll know a bit more in the next couple of days or so.
Yeah, hopefully in the next few days we'll start to sort of shore up exactly how Trevor's going to be moving and how quickly it's going to come through, as well as the timing of that front. But the front itself on Monday looks as though it'll bring some pretty windy conditions as it comes through, particularly for the southeast. So that's another one just to be wary of on top of the rainfall.
So someone said, Trevor, don't forget about Veronica. Has Veronica... Veronica moves. What's happened to Veronica? Veronica's gone?
No, Veronica is currently, it intensified overnight, so it's now a severe tropical cyclone. It's ranked at Category 4, and it's fairly slow moving off the northwest shelf of WA. So depending on how quickly it starts to lose its intensity, we could start to have a little bit of extra moisture being fed in from Veronica, but the main rainfall that we could expect in New South Wales looks to be more from Trevor rather than Veronica.
Okay, Trevor. Trevor rather than Veronica at this stage.
At this stage, yep.
All right, thanks, Gabrielle.
My pleasure.
Gabrielle Woodhouse at the Bureau. It's 23 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Well, got a few... someone's texted in saying, how come this cyclone's called Trevor? That one from Paul at Griffith. Well, they've got a list. They've actually got a list of... And it's all mapped out. I've seen the list just recently. It's all mapped out as to what the next name of the cyclone will be. So there's a list that's already been prepared for the next cyclone. Someone's texted in regards to the issue of inland rail. They've said, Graham at Wagga says, those in the know purchasing land on the inland rail route, anyone who has a government department offer compensation for land acquisition knows that the compensation never meets the real value of land, says Graham. Someone's Ben at Narromine's texted in on the issue of drought policy, saying, do any of the political parties have any room in their plans for helping farmers plant large areas of old man saltbush to help drought-proof their properties? These plants will survive droughts far better, but actually also help to improve native pastures between the rows and give amazing feed banks for the future as well. Yes, we've heard people talk about the great benefits they get from old man saltbush in the past. And someone else has texted in to say they're in the Southern Riverina and they're in a state of confusion at the moment regarding the election. They're saying they don't know who to vote for. And they're actually thinking of having a spin of the wheel on Friday night. Fair dinkum. They've got no idea in the southern irrigation areas about voting on the weekend. It's 21 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Well, let's turn our attention to wool now. And there's no better way to get a young person interested in agriculture than to give them some hands-on experience. And as dozens of high school students spend a day working with sheep near Crookwell in the Southern Tablelands, experienced farmers watched on, hoping to see what we could see from the next generation coming through. Tim Fuchs was there, and he filed this report.
The annual Flock U competition at Crookwell draws a reasonable crowd each year, but this year's day was something different. Dozens of high school students from the local area, as well as Bathurst and Goulburn, turned up to learn about wool.
This day is being put on in conjunction with the Flock U competition, the Flock U Championship. We're going to have a crowd of people arrive here around lunchtime, and then this afternoon we're going to be following them around and judging sheep. So I'll just give you a quick rundown of the day.
The day was hosted by Crookwell farmer Michael Lowe.
This is the first year we've tried this format of actually having the kids come on farm to a property, central lot property, run through a workshop and actually get their hands on sheep and learn about sheep. And then this afternoon they're going to follow the regional championship ewe competition, and they're going to judge four mobs of sheep of their own accord as a junior judging competition, but they're also going to be taking part and experiencing the real judges who are judging those flock ewes.
What does it mean to see so many young faces here who are keen to learn about the industry?
Oh, it means a great deal to me, and it should mean a great deal to any wool grower or farmer in general, really. I think it's incumbent on all of us to encourage our youth to come into this agricultural industry and to continue it on.
The day was hands-on, learning, getting experience. Some of the students were from a farming background, others had little knowledge of sheep or the wool industry before they arrived.
The condition of your sheep, your fat score of your sheep, for those opportune times like pre-joining, pre-lambing, to make sure they're in peak condition.
Sebastian Tapp from Goulburn was among those there.
Just to be able to judge sheep and just having a look at the merino sheep here today.
Do you know much about them?
Oh, a little bit, bits and pieces, not much, but out here to learn a bit. We're just looking at the fleece at the moment and at the back rib and stuff like that.
Darcy Slater and Ryan McKenzie have both grown up living on a farm, but say that a field day like this helps improve their knowledge of the sheep industry.
Live on a farm at Chewina, merinos and crossbeds.
What do you do on the farm when you're home?
Oh, just work for Dad, labourer.
What do you think about a day like this, you know, where you've got a whole lot of students from around the region here learning about, you know, just what a fleece is like, what a fat score is like?
Yeah, no, it's good. Good educational day for, you know, particularly for ag students.
What makes a good sheep?
Good wool and, you know, good meat count and whatnot. Crimp, lanolin cover.
Yeah, so we've got a sheep farm, running about 280 ewes.
What have you learned about today?
Learned a bit more about the structures of the sheep, what to look for in a good merino ewe. And
what do you know about the industry at the moment?
Well, the wool price is the best it's been for a long time, and yeah, the ewes are still getting good money, and so are lambs.
Is it your plan to stay on the farm?
I'd like to think so. Probably do something on a farm one day, and yeah.
Physical work, and we heard inside there that the average age of a farmer, you know, is late 50s, early 60s, so they need young blokes like you.
Yeah, they do, yeah. With the ageing farmer, like, some young fellas need to get into it and get amongst it.
For Morrigan de Monk from Goulburn, spending a day on farms, learning how to wool class, learning how to judge, was a day out of the classroom, getting hands-on experience.
Just about wool classing and whatnot, how to judge the sheep properly, a few little tricks on how to do it right.
What are the tricks?
Oh, look with your eyes and your hands instead of anything else. Just pay attention to the animals, look after them well.
Do you know yet what makes a good fleece?
Oh, just looking after the sheep, making sure they're well fed and good breeding, good bloodlines.
The event was organised by Australian Wool Innovation and travels around regional New South Wales trying to inspire younger people into the industry. And with wool prices as strong as they have been, AWI's Ben Watts knows there's no better time than the present to try and sell it as a career option.
We cover off on some basic fundamentals of industry around what is the market, what's the overall industry that we're all in this for to supply, but then also what we consider are some of the building blocks of working in industry, of understanding handling animals gently and quietly, but also assessing animals and assessing them for their commercial value, and also competing in a junior judging competition, because everyone knows young kids love a bit of competition. We've been running this program with Australian Wool Innovation across a number of sites now. We've run in the Riverina, Western New South Wales, here in the middle of Crookwell, in the Tablelands, in those lovely clouds. the feedback's always really positive. Students love coming out, being hands-on with animals, having a dog, working with them in the yards. It's great, and inquiry seems to be growing, so we're pretty keen to keep doing it.
Australia Wool Innovations' Ben Watt ending that report from Tim Fuchs.
I don't think you'll find anyone any better than the people in Australian agriculture throughout the world.
The country, yeah.
The country, yeah.
The country, yeah.
Had some comments about saltbush. Old man saltbush. Someone's texted in saying there are many useful saltbushes for livestock. Old man, thorny, creeping, ruby and bladder, etc. And on the milk price, John has texted in from Narromine saying the support for our we should actually support our dairy farmers. Ask yourself if you would trust imported dairy products from China. There are huge contamination issues in soils and water in China. And still on the issue of dairy as well, Alan has texted in to make an interesting point. He says, I'm very worried that Little Proud is going to force the price of fuel up at our local metro, and then if we don't, he shall probably call for a boycott of all metro service stations in New South Wales. I think he's drawing some similarities there between the dairy industry and supermarkets. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's coming up to... It's coming up to 14 minutes to one. Well, the Riverina Rice Bowl has been converted into corn country this season. Many irrigators who abandoned rice this summer due to low or no water allocations opted to grow corn, also known as maize, for the first time. The chair of the Maize Association of Australia, Bernie Walsh, isn't a newcomer to the crop after making a switch on his Yanko property 30 years ago. He's speaking here to Cara Jeffrey about his experience with the crop.
First of all, it was my soil type. It was too permeable for rice. As we went into the in the early 1990s, we were restricted with our water allocations. So I had to find a more water efficient crop, and that's why I phased the rice out and changed the farm into a raised bed system layout, and the maize was a good fit.
Being a drought year, is maize in demand?
Maize is in demand. What's driving the price though for maize is the cost of water, but also the stock feed. It just has to be the price it is now to be able to afford that water.
And what is the price roughly sitting around?
The price is I believe, sitting around about that $400 to $420 a tonne.
And so there's still some money to be made once water costs are taken out of that?
Yes, there is. Probably not sustainable price at that, but that is really a good price.
What type of maize is mostly being grown? Is it for human consumption or for stock feed?
Around this area, it's mainly for human consumption, but as we go further south, it's mainly stock feed.
And are there many export opportunities for maize to go offshore?
Yes, we've had a shipment go out from the Ord River to South Korea, which is very, very pleasing to see. It'll be grit and going into the human consumption market.
Water prices are very high at the moment, and if the dry conditions continue, do you expect maize will become more popular with Australian growers?
I think so, depending on the price, but I really do think there'll be more maize growing in that with its better water efficiencies and its high-end yields.
Are there concerns that there could be an oversupply?
No, I don't think that'll be a problem at all with the way... Maybe if the water was a lot cheaper and a lot more available, and the price could stay where it is, then I think there could be a glut, but I can't see that happening.
On average, how many megs of water per hectare does it take to grow maize?
For the longer season varieties, on average, it's sort of that somewhere between 8 to 10 megs, generally around about that 9 megs a hectare. But when you get into the popcorn and the high amylase varieties, you're back around that 6 megs a hectare, and then you've got your short season varieties, which would probably be similar to that too. So it does vary, but it's around that anywhere between 5 to to 10 megs a hectare. I think it's a little bit, uses about a megalitre less than the cotton. So, it's quite a good, it's one of the most efficient converters, users of water.
What type of yields are you seeing per hectare off a maize crop?
It's quite achievable to do 15 to 16 tonnes a hectare. When I first started growing the older varieties, it was 12 tonne was pretty much the max you could grow. But now we're seeing, these 15 to 16 tonnes are quite common.
And you've just retired from farming into Leeton from your Yanko farm, and you're finishing up soon as the chair of the Maize Association of Australia. How do you feel about the future of farming?
Really concerned. The future for irrigation farming, I do worry. In the present circumstances, I really do worry that there's not a great future for it.
Is that something that you're hearing from a lot of irrigators? Are there people that are opting to retire than push through and battle these high water prices?
Not really. There's a lot of talk. There's disgruntled farmers. That's for sure. But they're trying to hang in there and battle on. But for me, it was I thought that was the best thing I could do, was to get out.
Maize Association of Australian Chair Bernie Walsh from Leeton speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. It's 9 minutes to 1 on the Country Hour. A few more texts have come in regards to the Inland Rail. Tony's texted in to say it'd be interesting to see the political comments that were made when we first opened the network of railways in Western New South Wales for grain transport, a network that successive Liberal governments closed and dismantled amid plenty of protests during the 80s and 90s. And Barb on the rail issue too has texted in saying, in regards to Labor, thank goodness they think that we're worth listening to. They came to Dubbo and they listened and they acted. They're talking about a state inquiry into Inland Rail. We want our towns and communities to benefit, not just go straight past and have cut 5 shires and 40,000 people out of such an opportunity. We want the Inland Rail to go in the right place, she says, where it was originally going. It's 8 minutes to 1 on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, let's look at horses now. They call him the godfather of colonial thoroughbred breeding stallions. Star Kingdom was a horse whose influence is still evident in the bloodlines of many Australian thoroughbreds today. One of his most extraordinary achievements was to sire the winner of the first 5 Golden Slipper Stakes races. Now, this week, the breeding industry said farewell to the last person who handled Star Kingdom, Noel Hennessy from the Upper Hunter. Thoroughbred historian Bill Howie reflects on the partnership between the horse and the handler.
He was born in Maitland. He got a job with my late father-in-law at Table Creek, Dungog, after leaving school at age 14 and a half years. He then went for a short time to the Faulkners at Haddon Rig at Warren, looking after horses for Mrs. Faulkner, who showed a lot of horses. And then he came to Barrymore, and he took over from another stud groom in about 1957. And Star Kingdom died on the 21st of April, 1967. So therefore, for about the last 10 years of his life, when he was the most important thoroughbred in this part of the world.
And some would say that he still has that importance in the thoroughbred industry.
Well, it created a great dynasty, Mike. He was 5 times champion sire, of course, and everyone pretty much knows this story. And we have evidence in the last few days that people are logging in to lots of stories about Star Kingdom and his stud groom, the late Noel Hennessy. Now we've got the dawn of Danehill, but Star Kingdom isn't forgotten and he's not gone.
Let's look at the role of Noel Hennessy in looking after. What was his role?
He was the stud manager, stud groom, and he was responsible for nearly everything. Mr. A.O. Ellison, the late Mr. A.O. Ellison, owned Barrymore Stud Farm, but Noel lived there, and actually the cottage which he lived on was only really about 20 or 30 metres from Star Kingdom's box and yard, as well as Todman and the other stallions. So really, you almost lived with them 24/7.
The season, of course, would have been fairly hectic, being such a sire that he was.
Mike, there was one stud groom and maybe one, possibly two other people on the stud that helped you, and you did everything. Now, you looked after the stallions, you teased the mares, you foaled the mares, you looked after the foals, you cared for the mares, you prepared the yearlings, and you took them down to the yearling cells, and you did all of that.
The connection between horse and man, and in this case, Noel Hennessy and the horse, Star Kingdom. How close, and how can you judge how close it was?
I've seen this many, many times in the past. There is a special bond that develops. And actually, Peter Pring, in his excellent book, the late Peter Pring, The Star Kingdom Story, describes in detail, as, and one was that Star Kingdom would sulk whenever Noel went away, if on holiday, or take the yearlings to the yearling sales. And when he came back, he would grab him by the arm, and as if to say, don't you ever go away and leave me again.
That's thoroughbred historian Bill Howie. It's 5-1. Let's go to Wagga Sheep and Lambs now, and Rob Pearce.
Good afternoon. There were 25,000 lambs, down by 6,800. Quality was good for the supplementary fed lambs, along with the plainer lines, and they were mainly heavy and trades pen. The lighter grades were also well supplied. Medium and heavy trades were firm to a couple dearer, 18 to 20 kilos, 124 to 142, 20 to 22, 131 to 153, averaging 645 to 655 cents. Heavy weights were firm to four dearer, 22 to 24, 148 to 166, 24 to 26, 157 to 172, 26 to 30, 168 to 201, and 30 plus 210 to a top of 238.20. Stores sold from 66 to 116, and there were 10,500 mutton. Prices lifted 15 to 20. Heavy first cross ewes sold from 140 to 164, averaging 460. Heavy merino wethers sold from 152 to a top of 203.20, averaging 510 cents. And this has been Rob Pearce from MLA.
To Dubbo Cattle now, David Monk.
Good afternoon. Numbers are back by 370 fair yarding, 2,810. It was a fair quality yarding with a good selection of young trade cattle along with good numbers to suit the feeders. Gowns and young calves were well supplied, grass steers were limited. The market was dear up. Young cattle of the trade were 20 cents dearer with the prime steer yearling selling from 244 to 307, while the prime heifer yearling sold to 278. Feeder steers were 25 to 30 cents dearer, while the feeder heifers were 11 to 18 dearer. The feeder steers sold from 223 to 290, while the feeder heifers sold from 170 to 259. Young cattle of the restockers were 30 to 40 cents dearer, with the young steers selling from 150 to 258, while the young restocker heifers sold from 100 to 224. The few ground steers were 12 cents dearer, with the prime medium weights selling from 259 to 268. Cows were 30 to 40 cents dearer, with the two scores selling from 110 to 165. The better 3 and 4 score cows sold from 145 to 212 cents, with the prime heavyweights averaging 202. Bulls sold to 223. This is David Monk in Dubbo for MLA.
To Yass Cattle now and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Cattle numbers lifted to 1,642 and the quality was good. There were plenty of yearlings that suited feeders and a few weaners which went to restockers. Grown heifers numbers improved and most went on to feed. A large run of grown steers and close to 600 cows were offered in a dearer market. Weaner steers lifted 5 to 10 cents, 185 to 235, and plainer heifers sold to a dearer trend, 178 to 207. Feeder steers were 5 cents dearer, 230 to 270, and heifers were 9 to 12 stronger with the heavyweights, 244 to 264. Grown steers lifted 30 cents on quality, 258 to 280. The D2 grown heifers to feed, 185 to 228, and heavyweights to process reached 231. Cows with a big improvers lifted 30 to 35 cents. D2 cows, 120 to 174 to average 159. Heavy 3 and 4 scores, 170 to $2, averaging 190. And this has been Graham Richard for the MLA.
To Armidale Cattle, Stephen Adams.
Good afternoon. Armidale numbers similar at 2,025 head, with the exception of a limited offering of well-bred weaners, yearlings and some high-yielding cows, presented a fine quality yarding. All the regular operators attended. Steer weaners to restock saw a top of 249 cents to sell 170 to 249, seeing dearer trends of 40 cents, with heifers 166 to 194. Light steer yearlings saw a drop in trends of 6 cents, 201 to 216, while the medium weight saw dearer trends of 16 cents, 216 to 253. Medium heifers to feed sold to dearer trends of 60 cents, 212 to 232. Grain heifers of the trade were dear, averaging 2.26 and 17 cents better. Plain quality light cows to restock saw cheaper trends of 40 cents, selling 20 cents to 72. Medium D2 cows sold to 1.26 to 1.49 cents a kilo, 29 cents better. D3 cows saw dearer trends of 34 cents, 1.66 to 1.95. D4 cows saw significant rises of 36 cents a kilo to sell 170 to 218. Bulls were dearer with export categories to 224. The best of the slaughter bulls, 30 cents better, 167 to 203. Stephen Adams, MLA at Armidale.
That's the markets for today. I'm going to head out and have a look at the satellite and see what's happening with Trevor. Have a great afternoon. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.